What's going on, everyone? Welcome to Corner Table Talk. I'm your host, Brad Johnson. We are exploring subjects related to food plus drink plus culture. And as always, with your questions or comments about our show, you can reach me at brad@postandbeamhospitality.com. So, most of us are good at one thing. And if we are lucky enough to identify that and make a living doing it, I'd say that you're fortunate. Then there are those of us who defy the odds and seem to master whatever they touch based on where their interests might lead. Many of you will recognize my guest, Eric LaSalle, from his long career in film and television. His portrayal of the main antagonist, Daryl Jenks, heir to the Soul Glow hair product dynasty in Eddie Murphy's cult classic, Coming to America, is certainly unforgettable. But also, as well as his starring role portraying Dr. Peter Benton for 8 seasons on the award-winning drama ER. He's garnered many awards, nominations, numerous accolades, too many to list here. And to my point at the top, Eric, while a gifted actor, is also a talented director and now an author. That's not all. I've known Eric for quite a while, and something you may not know is that he is a savvy real estate investor whose impeccable taste and personal attention to the details of design and location selection create magnificent homes where Eric often generously entertains his friends. And I have been on that guest list. I hope I will still be after this show. Most recently, Eric has released his novel, Laws of Annihilation, a dark thriller. I read it, and we will certainly be talking about that and other things today. Eric also happens to be one of the coolest and most down-to-earth brothers that I know. Eric, what's happening, man? Nice to see you. Welcome to Corner Table Talk.
Hey, Brad. Thanks, man. Always great to see you.
Good to have you here, man. So we kick things off with my short order questions. I know you are a music head. Tell me, man, what's on your playlist? What are you listening to?
It's funny. So for the birthday party in July, Connie came. I turned everybody on. And I think he came back and tried to turn you on to it, but you already knew October London. A young brother. So that's been like really heavy, you know, on my list. Just that much soul and that young brother is. It's funny because we don't have a whole lot of the balladeers and the people that sing like that. So it's cool to see a 30-something-year-old brother doing that. So that's top of my list. I'm digging. Lela James is always on any list. Raheem Devon, Guapalé's back. Mm-hmm. This is that lean towards that, if you want to call that neo-soul vibe. But like those are the, and speaking of neo soul, there's a young sister who's been around and hasn't gotten her props yet, but she's blowing up, named Cleo Soul.
Oh, brother, I was going to mention her if you didn't.
Yeah.
No, she's 3 albums deep, man, and I haven't heard a bad cut yet.
Yeah. So I was just in New York and I was listening to her. And, you know, so she's there. So yeah, it was eclectic taste because then look, man, I'll switch it up and I'll have a day where I'm sitting outside grooving to Ed Sheeran. Adele, it's just my musical taste really is about the storytellers, telling that story. I think I'm one of the best storytellers out lyrically, delivery, all of that. Lela James, like they paint pictures and I listen to their music and I get inspired to write because they're basically telling a novel in a matter of 3 minutes sometimes. The whole course of a relationship. If you think about Adele's Hello, like that tells so much. Very visual. People can do it in an average song is 3 minutes. So if people can do it in 3 minutes, then when I'm telling stories in longer time, you try to have that discipline of keeping
it. Speaking of discipline, I know you take good care of yourself, man. So diet-wise, vegan, vegetarian, flexitarian, what are you consuming these days?
I don't. For 30 years, no red meat. I recently went back to a little bit. I love lamb. Lamb is definitely good for men. And so the occasional lamb. But for the most part, I'm poultry, seafood. The big thing for me is intermittent fasting. That's been the game changer for me because when I was running Chicago PD, in Chicago. Chicago has some of the most amazing food in the country.
I second that, man.
It's crazy food.
Yeah.
As soon as I got there, I put on 20. I was grubbing. And they had, when I got there, 2016, they had 22 Michelin star restaurants. And by the time I left, I had hit 18 or 19 of them. And so, but the intermittent fasting has been such a game changer when you read about what happens to the body after 14 hours of not having food. And then 17 hours when it starts kicking out the bad cells that a lot of times are the vulnerable cells or cancers. And so when you read all of the benefits, and basically it just means you give up breakfast. And so I'll eat at 8 o'clock at night and then not eat again until between 1 and 2.
Mm-hmm.
For me, that's fine. So that's been like a big thing, and doing the multiple saunas, try to do that multiple times a week because they've started seeing all the benefits of that as well. And they said that if you do saunas 3 to 4 times a week for 20 minutes, you cut down your risk for heart disease, dementia, stroke by 40 to 40%. Like, right. It's insane. So yeah. That's all.
Are you doing the cold plunge too?
I do the cold shower. I ain't doing
cold shower.
And it's funny, you went to my cribs, like my sauna is like next to the pool.
Right.
You could.
No.
And then I read this cool thing where they actually said, I do the sauna and then I do the cold shower. But I also read this cool thing where they said that if you simply dip your face in cold water, you're getting a lot of the benefits of the entire cold plunge because mm-hmm. of all the nerve endings in your face and where connections. How it basically benefits the entire body.
Yeah.
Haven't gotten to that yet.
Mm-hmm.
That's also.
That makes sense. Eric, I read recently too, that if you can do 40 pushups, you reduce your heart attack stroke risk by 97%.
Wow.
Wow. I'm at about 20. So 20 good ones. Sure. Maybe 25 not so good ones, but that's the goal. That's the goal. We'd all like to get there. So, man, as you mentioned, I have been to your house, and it's absolutely stunning. I'm curious, where do you write, Eric? Where do you find a place in the house or outside, given the view, that you really settle into and do your best work, or do you move around? What's your vibe that way?
I move around. I don't want a traditional office because now with laptops, the game has changed. So I have a ritual of jumping around depending on the placement of the sun. And but I love to start my day. You've been in my Zen garden. So I've got like this just real chill giant Buddha with the waterfall, like to start the day with the birds. So that's really cool. Once the sun starts coming up on that area, I go to the opposite part of the property, chill under the gazebo. So I like to bounce around. Then indoors as well, I have different spots. So technically, dude, I've got at least six spots that I write, depending on. And then because there's a lot of pacing, there's a lot of the kind of the stuff that I write. Sometimes I'm almost acting it out. So it depends on where I am for those real quiet moments. It's great to start the day in the Zen garden and the connection with the universe, Earth, and God.
You nailed that location, man. You've done well, but you've nailed that location.
Thanks, brother. Thank
yep.
you.
So I want to bounce around a little bit, man. I want to talk to you about a few things, but I want to start with a mutual connection that we have geographically. My mom and dad are both from Hartford, Connecticut, as is our dear friend, Connie Napier, who we talk about a lot and whose name might come up a few times during the course of this conversation. And you grew up in Hartford, Connecticut. And yeah, I remember summers there, man, on Tower Avenue and Keeney Park and horseback riding in Keeney Park and just wandering through the woods. Just an amazing place. Hartford also had its rough spots, Stowe Village, Bellevue Square. Hartford was no joke. And I remember going to Weaver for basketball games. I think you attended Weaver, right? Yeah. So if you would, man, talk about Hartford a little bit. Share your memories of your upbringing there. What was that environment like? Just give us a little taste of Eric LaSalle's Hartford back then.
I'm 40. I lived on the corner of Edgewood and Vine, and what's called the North End of Hartford. Edgewood is named Edgewood because it literally is on the edge of the park. So it's so basically, I grew up right across the street from Kinney Park, which is the most famous park there. It's huge. And so I spent a lot of time. I think that was the place where, like, the incubation of dreams for me. Because I would take my dog, I come home, I take my dog literally right across the street to the park. And I spent so much time in the park just sitting and dreaming. And I think that's when you start thinking about all these, at that time, crazy things that you want to be and how you see your life playing out. And even when there's no evidence, that's the light you will. That was the incubation of the dream. For me, Hartford was very much like architect in a way of that. My mother was a, you know, single parent who worked at a dry cleaners, but scraped up enough money to put together a nice house for her and her kids. You know what I mean? So it was that kind of planting those kinds of seeds. So when you talk about my homes now, and when I talk about the incubation of things, that's where that comes from. It comes from my mother's sense of what a home is supposed to be. I had a healthy, happy childhood. Wasn't perfect, but very happy, great foundation. We obviously having an amazing mother, but how the neighborhood looked out after you, like my mother being single, she always instilled the fear in us that I got eyes on you. Cause that's how it was. Like, people were looking out, everyone. And mm-hmm. then the other thing I'll say is we had teachers that really care, and Black, white, Latin. I remember I had a teacher by the name of Alan Rosinski, and he was whatever. He saw something in me, and he always made sure that I joined these summer programs. This is, I think, pre-Reaganomics. And so I started doing Avon Old Farms and had a summer program for inner city kids. And so they would take us out to Avon Old Farms, which is one of the top schools in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And we would stay out there. So we got to see how the other half lived. And there were lakes, so we'd go canoeing. This was our camp. And that instilled, again, this love of water for me. That's why, like, when I pick a house, I try to pick a house that has a view of water, because mm-hmm. I fell in love with that by being in this program. So mm-hmm. there was so many seeds for me, Hartford. There were so many seeds planted. Just and they're still with me now. Seeds that my mother planted, seeds that the dreams I had at Hartford planted, the seeds that friends. That's what Hartford represents to me.
Yeah. You're a tall, handsome guy, man. Were you always popular?
I became popular as a freshman in high school. But I discovered acting at the time, and we made the drama club sexy. And then the drama club made us sexy, if that makes sense. We did a couple of productions and everybody went crazy over them. So the next thing you know, you had this built-in popularity. And so I rode that through high school. But I take a lot of pride in it, because we created the thing that made us popular. We always pursued the passion. And whether it was the passion of athletics, whether it was the passion of the arts, whether we pursued the passion, and everything else came with that. And so I never sat around and said, oh, I want to be popular. Mm-hmm. I discovered I used to want to write when I was first. I wanted to be a doctor. Then I was like, I'm scared of blood. So I was like, that ain't going to work. Then I started loving. I used to read a lot. And then I started writing poetry. That led me to wanting to write a play, to perform. And that's how I started acting, because I showed up for auditions, but I thought I was going to be able to write some masterpiece play. And the drama teacher looked at me and said, look, I need you to audition. It was for Raisin and the Sun. I need you to audition, and I don't want to hear it. And I did. And then that started my acting career at 14. And then I joined outside drama clubs and travel right. around. So that's where the bug, but it's cool now, this stage in my life, in the last 10 years, that writing has come back, because mm-hmm. writing was technically a love before acting, mm-hmm. but I made my career as an actor. But now I'm getting to enjoy having a career as an author and an actor and a director and a producer. So it's really cool how the universe, I don't want to necessarily self-corrects itself. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Talk a little bit, if you would, about the Artist Collective. I know it was an interdisciplinary cultural institution in Hartford that was founded by the saxophonist Jackie McLean and his wife Dolly. And I know you participated in that. Could you share a little bit about that?
So I was encouraged to go to, once I found acting, to go to like Artist Collective. They stepped in and started doing plays. My mother started noticing improvements in my grades, started seeing a maturity in me, started seeing a sense of responsibility. So she pushed that and would threaten to take it away if I didn't clean my room. If my and I went from Artist Collective and organizations like that. You got to realize, as a freshman in high school, when girls started noticing me, and I'll never forget, I got my first leather jacket. As a freshman, you couldn't tell me my shit was,
you couldn't tell me anything.
And started getting, going in that route, got to the point where I was almost going to be held back. And it boiled down to one test, one teacher. And I technically flunked an exam, but she gave me 2 points to pass me. So I wasn't kept back. But I went from that as a freshman to honor roll in my junior and senior year. So that's the effect of acting and the effect of the art. But so Artist Collective is where I met my mentor, Clay Stevenson. And that was
Clay. That name comes up in some of your writing. I don't know if there's a connection.
That's why. Yeah. That's the character named after him. My production company is called For Clay Productions. No, he was instrumental. This was the guy that saw something in me and pushed me and held me accountable, young man. And I had never heard of Juilliard. He was the one that said, I think you have the potential to enough skill to go to Juilliard.
Let me ask you, because that leads to my next subject. Your next level of education, Juilliard, NYU, Tisch School, these are some highbrow institutions. So when you were thinking about the next level for yourself and those schools were being discussed, did you see yourself as someone that should be at that level of higher education? Was that a goal of yours? Was it instilled by Clay? Where did that come from, Eric?
Look, it was instilled by Clay. I'm going to be honest. I had never heard of you. It was the fact that somebody that I believed in, who believed in me, and someone that I thought was just this elevated intellectual person, artistic person, loving person, compassionate, worldly person he had lived in. So he was the epitome of a mentor, right? And so it was him saying, you should go here, place on as possible. He worked with me. Sometimes he was directing some stuff in New York. He'd come back to Harvard. Sometimes, man, we'd be up. I remember one time for my audition, I was over at his place for like, till 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm falling asleep. It's my audition. I'm falling asleep. And I wake up and he's still giving me, and at some point I looked at him. I'm like, this dude can't be more invested in my dream than I.
There's a meticulous nature to everything you do. You don't do anything just a little bit. When it's food, you want Michelin. You want to at least know that. I'm not saying that you're a food snob, but, and when it comes to design and your homes and your writing, there's an attention to detail and a follow through with the effort that anybody that knows you just has to admire. When did that happen, man? When did that click in?
I just think that's our upbringing. I think a lot of that is my mother. I think it starts with my mother. I think it started with every mentor, like I said, from my fourth grade teacher, because these people were imparting wisdom at times. Sometimes it didn't come off as wisdom. It just came off as conversation. But you admired, these people were so admirable that you wanted, I know like with Clay would say some very profound things. Mr. Marshall was my fourth grade teacher. He would, sometimes they would just say things. So even at, you know, fourth grade, when you're 9 years old, you just say things that you just want to emulate. And when they're telling you detail, they're telling you accountability, they're telling you to think things through, they're telling you to plan. Even before you can really grasp the expanse of that, it's a seed that someone that you admire has said, has fed you. Mm-hmm. At some point, it just becomes your food, if that makes sense. And then mm-hmm. before you know it, that food turns into muscle mass. It turns into muscle memory.
Muscle memory, yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. It just turns into, so anything, if I had to, it's muscle memory for me to, because I see the benefits of being, I see people not following through. I see people being, doing half-assed things. I see you've had incredible success in your industry. And I, people, that doesn't just happen. So I'm always, again, I'm attracted to people that do that. Like you and I are boys, Connie, like we're boys because we are like-minded in ways. There was a period I was studying you. I was studying what you did with Georgia Restaurant. I still talk about that. That is unprecedented. I tell people how you can go to Georgia's and there'd be Fred Flav over here, Sidney Poitier, Steven Spielberg, and Snoop. It's just like this, that takes, you don't just randomly publish. That takes thought. That takes detail. That takes training a staff to accommodate that, to make that. And so following that, so I study things, even if it's not my field, even if it's not my profession. I think one of the things that separated me from many of my peers is that I had that hungry mind that was willing to be molded, and I was fortunate enough to be around strong and positive people that could mold it in a strong and positive.
I appreciate that, man. I really do. We had some good times at all those spots. But so let's go to the 80s now. Let's fast forward from your education in the arts. And I think it was 87, 88, the audition for Coming to America. That had to have been Eddie. There was no bigger star on the planet at that point than Eddie Murphy, right? And there weren't a lot of parts for Black actors. It was some Broadway happening. Some theater was happening. But it was not what we would see in years later. So you get this, you have an agent, I presume, you get a call, you go on an audition, whatever that process was like, you get the part. What was that like for you, Eric? What was the audition process? What was the actual getting of the part? How did you find out? Where were you? How big a deal was that?
That was one of the most unique situations for me in the sense that, again, yeah, your agent sends you on a gazillion auditions if you're fortunate. And so you go, one never knows what's going to hit what's, but like you said, the opportunity to be in a movie with the biggest star on the planet at the time, obviously amped up. It was at Paramount Studios. They weren't even letting us on the lot to park. So I remember this. I had to park off of Melrose, on a little side street. No, dude, whatever. We got to the gate, go in. Everybody that looks like you don't look like you. Everybody's there. Everybody's there. This is 1988, 87, 88. Dude, it was around 5 o'clock. It was in the fall. I remember these details because I remember when I came out of the audition, it was now dark, but it wasn't super late. So I go in, I do my audition. John Landis is the director, and John Landis was crazy. As well.
Michael Jackson videos, right?
Yeah. Animal House, any Trading Place. This dude was killing it. He had more control than most directors because there's the process of the director, the producers, the studio. Everybody weighs in on every decision.
Mm-hmm.
So I go in, I audition. Good audition. He gives me a note. I do it again. Even better. He starts talking to me. He starts laughing.
This is still the first audition, your first meeting.
First and only.
Right.
Okay. And he says, okay, good. You got the part. And I said, no, good. I'll see you on set. I go, excuse me? He goes, yeah, I'll see you on set. I said, well, what does that mean? Because you have to wait a week.
Sure. Yeah. Get called back in another reading.
It's between you and it's never that clear and that direct and that easy. And so he goes, yeah, so I go, and I'm literally, dude, my IQ at this point is, because I'm like, duh, huh? I've never heard this. I'm like, huh? The point where he goes, you have the part. And I'm going, almost, isn't there a whole chain? And he goes, no, you have the part. And then there was just something in his eyes that clicked for me where I was like, and then you want to be cool. Mm-hmm. And the reason I said I remember how what time it was, because when I go outside, now it's dark. I'm on this side street. I am jumping, skipping.
Oh, man.
Doing so
much, man.
All the way to my little van.
With the car.
But the reason that is important is because when I can, and I'm not always in a position to do it, now that I'm a director and a producer, when I can, I love telling actors in the room that they got the part. It is the most powerful, empowering, gratifying moment to let someone mm-hmm. know that instant gratification, that your work is instantly being validated. It's not going through this committee. It's not, you're going to have to wait 2 weeks. You got all the ups and downs. And when it gets to Thursday or Friday, you're sweating. You're just waiting for that phone. This is before cell phones. You're just mm-hmm. waiting for that phone call. And the later it gets, at 6 o'clock, oh my God, the agent's going to start leaving. Now I got to wait for the weekend. You don't even have a good weekend because you're so nervous about getting a role. He took all of that out. So when I can return the favor, when I can tell, and I've had that happen a few times, I'm not as powerful as John Landis was in his height, but when I've had the opportunity to tell an actor on the spot, cool. And it comes from that moment. I'll never forget how magical moment was for me, and I try to get other artists.
Yeah. The idea that you are potentially advancing someone's dream in that moment, and you can,
as someone did
for you, man, that's fantastic. I love that. So let's jump ahead. And I know ER made you a household name, recognizable face, and I think it made you a few dimes along the way. What, if anything, would you, reflecting back on that TV series, that show, what, if anything, would you like to share about your time there?
I thought it was an amazing experience. It was, like you said, all those things, international fame, money, but obviously the more important things for me. So what people don't understand, Lawrence Fishburne said it best. Lawrence Fishburne said, they pay me a lot of money not to act. I do that for free. They pay me a lot of money to wait in my trailer to enter. So what people don't understand is, if you're an artist, you would do this. You do what you love. You don't have to be an artist. Whatever. If you're, whatever your passion is, you would do for free, ultimately. Mm-hmm. If you can, you would do it for free. So that's what I'm saying. I've never sought out money. I never even knew what kind of money. When I got into acting, I didn't know what kind of money was available. This, you know, stuff that you start learning. And then you start learning that money means power. Money means respect. Money means those things. Yeah, it becomes more important to you. But that was never my priority. This show gives it, but the bigger thing than those accolades and benefits is I got to play an African-American doctor, and not as a, you have to realize back then we were just supporting roles. We were, the majority of my roles were to be the support for the white guy, to be the sounding board for the white guy. There are so many roles that I had where I would say two lines and then my white male counterpart would give a monologue and I'd say another. So I was there to just feed him. So here was this unapologetic, strong man who was gifted, who was abrasive at times, who was whatever, but he was talented, he was driven, and he was a lead. So as progressive as the show was, and I take nothing, it was amazing, and we were ahead of, I still had to fight every day for certain things that my white male counterparts got to take for granted. Like simple things like in the first couple of seasons, you didn't see me on a date with a black woman. And I would tell the writers, black people go on dates as well. So that seems really weird saying that now, but the mindset then, it just wasn't in their psyche. So so George and Anthony, like they're going to jazz club. It's so funny. They're doing the thing. They're like, yeah, they get to go out and even get our music. So they're going to jazz clubs. They're doing all kinds. And in the meantime, they show me with a black woman. We're either fighting or having sex. Like there weren't those nuances. So I'm fighting and fighting for that. So every day there were some battles, even though, again, the show was progressive. Take nothing away from that. We dealt with some things or ahead of its time. And most importantly, we had an African-American doctor.
I'm thinking, too, how many young, obviously that show was so popular and ran for so long and your role was so prominent. How many young people were encouraged to pursue a medical profession? Parents, even.
Still get it. And I still get it now. Bet. Run into people and they say, hey, listen, you helped us through med school. That's black, white, male, female. And those are the ones that really touch you. Some people go, I'm a doctor. You helped that just by taking that edge off. Thursday nights was like religion for med students. I knew I was winning. I don't feel it's a win until it's completely. So even if I'm here, I'm like, why am I here if I'm working as hard as everyone else? And so that's that, hence the battle. And then unfortunately got to a point where it wasn't until they put me in an interracial relationship that they started having my character to do the date and to show different sides of themselves. And it was a very popular relationship on the show, like one of the best testing relationships. And I went to the producers and told them that they had to end it because they never showed the balance of a black man, woman. They only showed this wonderful, vulnerable social side of me was when I was with a white woman. And I said, that's sending a message that I'm not comfortable sending. I don't want to send a message to black women that we as black men, we don't put the effort in.
Unless we
put the effort here. That's you can have that opinion all you want. You're just not going to use me to perpetuate it, to promote it. And I got to tell you, one of the proudest moments is when black women started feeling seen and spoken up for.
It also occurs to me, Eric, in listening to you describe that, how culturally, given the time, the stand that you take at the risk of whatever that might be, breaks down a barrier that's an unintended, potentially unintended barrier. And it's a cultural, the person who is ever writing, who's writing the scene or writing the what the storyline's going to go, is not thinking like you're thinking. And you're opening up that pathway for thought may have changed that person's trajectory, but it may have also opened up a pathway for the next person coming along and say, no, I remember how they did that on ER, and that didn't quite go over well with the Eric LaSalle. I'm not going to make that mistake going forward. So much cultural pathway, man, you created as a first in that area. I'm going to risk jumping over a major part of what you've been doing before you were really spending a lot of time doing this writing. You as a director, I can totally get it. Dick Wolf is a smart man to employ you as often as he does. Because again, it's your meticulous way of spotting details, man, and making those subtle, it's like I relate it to the restaurant, man, where it's turning down the lights. It's making sure that the tablecloth has a little bit of depth beneath it. All those little nuances that we do that are not even perceptible necessarily to the person. But when you enter that room, when you enter an Eric LaSalle scene, that the thing has happened for you without you needing to be aware of it, and it feels right.
Yeah.
Same thing with your writing, man. And I want to turn to that now, because this trilogy that you've written, these a lot of pages here. There are a lot of words between these three books, and you cover such a wide spectrum of, we're talking about weighty subject matter like religion, spirituality, race, white supremacists, pedophilia, violence, sexuality, morality, abandonment, father and son relationships, death, faith. It's all there in varying degrees. And like you would, not just a novel, but you write a trilogy, right? Three of these. Give me your mindset, man, about, and I know writing was initially your thing. What prompted you to take on the idea of, did you start with the idea that you were going to write three books? Did it begin that way or did that evolve?
I've been writing novels now for 11 years. It started in 2012. And maybe in 2011, I attempted to write a novel, didn't go over something, just didn't come together. But then I didn't want to give up and I just kept trying. For me, it's always the lessons, and I feel like I like to be a student of the game. And I think when you're a student of the game, you understand that you take someone, like, and it's weird because it almost feels like he's more appreciated in death than he was in life. But if you really take, you talk about work ethic, you take someone like Kobe's work ethic was just off the chart. Just off the chart. And you hear more about it
now. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Which is just kind
how
of
many players admired him that had to be at odds with him.
He hated him when he was playing. You know what I mean? So I'm like, okay, I don't know. But it's similar to what you were saying about dimming the lights at a restaurant, making sure. See, what we do, and when things are done well, people don't have to understand all the detail. They have to understand the experience, the feeling of it. So sometimes people can taste food. They can't quite understand all the flavors that get you. They just know, oh, God, it's delicious. That's fine. The craftsmen, the academics, they come in. It's their job to analyze, oh, my God, there was this and this, there was this and that. So when people look at cinema or people read a book, you don't have to get everything. You have to get what's the feeling that it leaves you. Because there might be things that you can't even explain. There might be things that you can't describe. But Maya Angelou says, people will forget what you say to them. They will even forget sometimes what you do to them. They will never forget how you make them feel. And so this detail that we do, it's how we make people feel. I want people to feel a certain way when they read my books. I want people to understand that there's an underrepresentation of people of color in this particular genre, thriller writers. There's Walter Mosley's the godfather of it, but and now S.A. Cosby is a brother that's killing it in this field. But pound for pound, we haven't really been able to express ourselves much in this. So just like Octavia Butler, were no science fiction writers until of color. Octavia comes along, blows up the scene. So that's what we tend to. For me, having the opportunity to write in this genre, I wanted to take it further. I said, my agent said, you're heady. And I took it as a compliment. Because see, thrillers are usually there's a short shelf life. It's like you read it, the good guy's going to catch the bad. That's the nature of crime and thrillers. So I wanted to throw more in there. So the character's personal journey, the character's spiritual journey, the character's romantic journey, those are as much in jeopardy as the case that they're pursuing. Mm-hmm. So it's not just about, are they going to catch the bad? Are they going to survive intact? Are they going to lose their soul? Are they going to lose their loved ones? Are they going? So this is what creates, even for me, even better mystery and fiction, because if you do the math, 9 out of 10 times, the bad good guy catches the bad guy. That's the nature. Otherwise, they're incompetent. So why do we root for them? So understanding that structure, I'm like, I can keep people tense with, wow, this person's relationship with his gay brother, this relationship with his father, this relationship with this Jewish, half-Jewish woman who doesn't have a relationship with her Judaism. And she's investigating a hate crime. Where is she going to end up? And in the last one, you double down because your protagonist, you find out early on, is diagnosed with terminal cancer. So it's not just about the case. It's about, will they survive? And what I'm out to prove that you can have these deep subject matters about spirituality, about a journey, religion, all of these things, and still have this cool thriller where will the good guy catch the bad? That's the essence of my writing. That's the foundation.
Well, one of those moments, man, really stayed with me to your point. And I loved the idea of Clay, Faye, and AJ, the father and the two sons, and what the dynamic was. And also, I don't want to give anything away, what happened with AJ and how that played for Clay and how that played for Faye. But I wanted to, if you would, Eric, because there was one scene in particular. You mentioned the character Macklin, who's the protagonist in Laws of Annihilation. And I'm not giving anything away because you just did. She's been diagnosed with terminal cancer. And as that's happening, she's also got some things that are happening on the professional side of her life that would be everything she's ever wanted. Right. And she's neglected her personal life. She's taking care of her physical needs, but she's neglected. But what happens in life, right? We sometimes dedicate ourselves to one thing at the expense of something else. But I ask, if you would, man, if you wouldn't mind reading from the top of page 72, because you get into a description of her state of mind in that moment as her lover is leaving a hotel room. They've had a little rendezvous and she's left there with her thoughts. Would you mind, Eric, taking from the top of page 72, Laws of Annihilation?
Sure, I would love that. And just some context, this is a woman who has kept love at bay, because she feels that it compromises. So it's easier for her to fulfill the carnal. So she's, and this is this lover, she has basically kept at bay. So that's the other thing. I love adding love stories in the midst. Like each, if you look at each book, it's a love, there's a love story as much as a crime involved. So this is the beginning. So he turned, opened the door, then stopped. He kept his back to her. He stood there. No words, no movement. She allowed the moment, endorsed it even. She felt it was the least she could do, knowing that she would never see him again. They heard a couple from somewhere down the hall. There was distant laughter that was muted, then swallowed by a closing elevator. Even when Loscher found his voice, he still kept his back to her. "I'm sorry, Janet, that I wasn't enough to make you want to give us a real try." As he left, the hollow clanking of the closing door bounced off the walls and then through her as though she were nothing but air. The deep quiet left her feeling alone until she quickly realized she was anything but. Loscher had left his scent behind as if it were a trained pet whose sole purpose was to remind her of his absence. Even as she stood by the window, she could still smell him, while his final words tumbled in her head, like a damp load of laundry just beginning its cycle.
Brother, I want to come back to that last line, but the muted sound of a couple in the elevator as Loscher is standing in the doorway, and then it's muted as the door is closed. How do you not visualize? I know everything that's happening in that room, and the idea of thoughts tumbling through your mind. We all know the sound that a dryer makes with wet, right? How the hell did she connect what was going on in her mind in that moment to the sound of what laundry does in a wet laundry does in a dryer?
Because it's my job as a writer to get you there, to put you there, and you have your own space for interpretation. Some of these lines, this section might hit you harder than someone else, and another section might hit them harder than it hit you. But it's my job to try to create, and I find the best way for me to create is to animate. I animate and make things personified. You take these inanimate objects, you take, everything feels alive. So it's like his scent. See, to me, it's so cool. You have this conversation with someone, they leave you and you're alone, And then you realize you're not alone because that scent is there reminding you and shaking you. And like I said, like a trained pet. It's like a dog mm-hmm. going, yeah, he's still here. He's still here. So you have that. And then just to have this last, and it's the last sentence of that section, just to have this person standing there with this scent of a lover that she's rejected love from. She's used his body, but she's rejected love from it. I also wanted to flip that dynamic to put her in the historically male position, because it's usually the man that's keeping the woman at bay. And when we think of those sometimes stereotypes or whatever. So here's a woman who's rejecting love from her lover and just keeping it sexual. And she's left there with his scent. And she's left there with her thoughts, and her thoughts are Gadun.
Right.
And that's your protagonist. So it's not just about solving a case. You're like, oh my God, is she ever going to be happy? Will she be happy before the whatever of her, what's going to happen with her life and her medical? And those kind of moments for me are so rich and so interesting. And it's interesting that you picked up on, because yeah, sometimes you go back and you reach it and you go, that's good.
I got that one. It's like replaying one of those nice plays on a court in your mind. Yeah, I took that brother that time. You brought it. You brought that line, man. I highlighted it. I was like, all right. But it all through the book, man, there are so many moments like that. I want to move on just a bit, Eric, because again, you take on these very, and it's funny, is it art imitating life, imitating art, whatever, but one of the groups in Laws of Annihilation, and again, I don't want to give anything away, so I'm going to be very careful here, but this white supremacist group whose fear reflects a lot of what we hear about, read about in the news. We know our country's divided. We know what the impact of 2016 to 2020 was, and COVID and mask, no mask, vaccine. And yet it's fear-based. It's fear that, in fact, you go on to say in one of the manifestos is that one of the characters in that white supremacy group is talking. They talk about the infiltration of law enforcement, government, pitting Jews against blacks. A lot of this stuff we see and we read about, and who's who? You're not taking off the hoods and wearing suits and wearing uniforms. Who is who? And so I guess as my question to you, man, is as you reflect on what you've written here, the stories that you've created, whatever you've pulled from, what influences you about real life, where are we on this arc of progress, man? Are we still bending this thing in the right way? Have we hit an impasse? Where are we?
We're in a very scary position. And this is one book, considering the subject matter, this is one book that I'm a little scared of, because the shit that I'm writing about is still going on. And I knew this book would still be relevant. And the rise of anti-Semitic crimes is at an all-time high. And so it's not one of those things, and to be very selfish, you're like, would I sacrifice the success of the book if I knew the world was going to be better? And people go, oh, that's old. That doesn't happen anymore. The scary thing is when I set out to write it, I was like, even in a few more years, it's still going to be relevant. Mm-hmm. Obviously, and ironically, one of the first reviews was talking about how timely it is, how mm-hmm. relevant it is. So it's scary when you're writing about something that should not be happening, that we should be past, and knowing that it will still be relevant. And so when you start hearing about these synagogue incidents and murders and just hate and all of that, it's there and it's historical. And I wanted to explore the parallel between two of the three most oppressed groups in this country, obviously first and foremost, Native Americans, but then African-Americans and Jewish people. And so, but yet even we are divided. And I just found it interesting to examine these two groups that share similar and differences and similarities in our oppression and sometimes being marginalized. And but yet there's such space between us, and it can be so easily manipulated. So one of the themes of the book is really how easily this hate and this apprehension and this
can be exploited.
Can be exploited.
Yeah.
And when you have that,
you landed right in the middle of where we are, man.
There's one thing I want to say, because I've actually been looking forward to this discussion for a while. And we were going to do the second book. And so each book focuses a little bit more on our three protagonists. So the first one was Quincy Kavanaugh, who's Irish, Italian, American. And so the first case was focused a little bit more on him. The second case was focused a little bit more on Fee, who's African American. And his father, Clay. And I just, like I say, man, I take sprinkles throughout my life that I find interesting and I'll run with it. And in a very interesting way, Fee and Clay is actually you and your father.
What?
Yeah.
Seriously?
Yeah. I've been wanting to have this conversation
for
a long time. Yeah. The closeness of how those two men are, that dynamic.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
That's touching, man.
Those two, obviously I know of your father's story, talking you and Connie, but that closeness was just legendary.
Wow, man.
Bond between the two of you. And so to have this African-American, now his father was ex-gangster, but
right,
a powerful figure, and them navigating even the show of I'm a man now, I'm not this, and you know
brother.
What I mean? So I thought we were going to have this conversation.
That's really deep, man, because I know we're running short on time, but I do want to bring this up because I picked up on, obviously, the Clay character is an ex-gangster who's got a ruthless streak. He's accomplished a lot by violence and doing what you have to do in the streets. Yet Fee has some of those same characteristics, but he's on the other side of the law. And I was, what I related to is so funny that you say that, man, because Clay has an quick temper. My father's nickname was Quick Fuse because he had such a bad temper. And I'm aware of the same inclination towards temper, and I have to monitor it now. But here you have a son who's got a badge and a uniform and is trying to do good, but he's got these same personality traits as his dad, who accomplished what he accomplished, but in a much different way. And I was working with that a little bit.
Because it's also this beautiful moment of also realizing, as much as I love my father, as much as I respect my father, as much as I honor my father, I'm different from my father. And that was Fee's moment. He had to go through hell in the second book to get to this moment. And he takes nothing. The cool thing is there's no judgment on his father.
Right.
His father now, that's more of the path, but the horse, the past from the way. But his father's now this big, legitimate power broker now. Mm-hmm.
Connections
He's the most powerful, considered to be the most powerful man in New York, who happens to be black and an ex-gangster. But Fee, going through hell, going through that case, ends up in a position where he's been haunted by the fact that I am vulnerable to my father's tendencies. I'm vulnerable to those genes and this temper and this darkness. But it's only through him going through hell that he realizes, I'm not my father. I'm liberated from that. So as you connect, you're like, oh, I got to deal with these things. But there comes this wonderful moment where we start realizing I am, no matter how influenced I am by someone, I'm ultimately my own man.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a beautiful moment.
Thank you for that, man. I'm flattered, as my dad must be looking down proud of you, man. And as we both are, I want to just touch on your design sense, man, because and I want to recommend the books to everyone. And I'm sure some smart executive producers already ringing you up saying, man, we got to turn this into a franchise. And if they haven't yet, they will be ringing you soon. But where does your eye come from, Eric? What is that in you? Is that just the creative you that dives into that stuff?
I think I fell in love with the word that I apply to everything I do. And that word is transportive. And I think that experiences can be transportive. They can take you places. And so I look at whether it's real estate, whether it's cinema, whether it's a book, I look at trying to take you someplace. So if I can create a transportive moment, then I feel satisfied. If I can get you to, when you read books, you go to this place because you see these characters, you feel these characters, and you're in a different world that you would never, you and I, fortunately, we've encountered racism, but we've never encountered racism the way that Laws of Annihilation deals with white supremacists, murder. We've never dealt on that level. So, but if I can transport the reader to that level, when I'm directing a show, I can transport you to this moment, then I feel satisfied as an artist. If I can transport you, a friend of mine once told me, he said, you don't build houses, you direct. Because he created me building a home the same way that I direct. And I don't know which comes first. I don't know. So if anything, I try to curate whatever it is I'm doing to create a transportive moment or moments, multiple moments that take you someplace. And that's what sticks. That's what resonates. That's a goal. But that's intentional.
Like, man, your friends matter to you. And they don't have to be famous. Obviously, there has to be something there that maintains a spark over time. Those of us that are lucky enough to be in your inner circle and spend time with you socially, we know that you value friendship and brotherhood. What's that mean to you, man?
I take the work seriously. I don't take Hollywood seriously. I don't take the mechanic. I don't need to be at every party. I don't need to be at every premiere. I don't need to have the best table in the restaurant. I don't get off on those things. I get off.
You've had some pretty good tables.
I've had some good tables. It's just good to have people around that keep you grounded, keep you simple. We don't put on airs with each other. We're not lying to each other. I don't know if you remember this. Me, you, and another good friend of ours, Russell, I think we drove to Vegas for a fight. And we just had a cool conversation on the ride. And I just remember listening to how you were holding him responsible for something. And he ultimately welcomed it. And I was like, that's the kind of friendship that makes us better. Where I can say to you, you know what? I think your point of view, I think this, I think that. And you start thinking about it and go, you know what? Maybe I was a little whatever, but as opposed to you just us kissing each other's ass, you've accomplished this, you've accomplished that. No, man, keep it simple and keep it honest. And that's something that I strive for. And the best way to strive for it is starting off with surrounding yourself with. God either wants you to have it. If God wants it for you, nobody can take it from you. If God doesn't want it for you, nobody can give it to you. I got people that I go, yo, they're going to be solid no matter what. They're not going to be just because I'm on top of my career right now. They're going to be solid when I'm on the lower end of my career and vice versa.
Absolutely, man. Thank you. So before I leave you, man, I know you're a spiritual guy. Where are you on the meditation importance, Buddha, God? Where are you in the spirituality spectrum right now? What brings you peace?
It's simple for me. Like, I don't consider myself religious. I consider myself spiritual. I follow the doctrines of Christianity. I believe in God. I believe in Jesus. Most of all, I believe in treating people the way I want to be treated. So my thing is, I don't care where a person comes from. There are plenty of Christians that are so hypocritical. I'd rather be down with an atheist who treats people well. So whatever, my thing is this, whatever you follow, if it's not pushing you to be your best and helping you and pushing you to be the best that you can to others and as well as to yourself. That I don't care what name you call it. I don't, because there are plenty of wicked, selfish, dangerous, religious people. And then there are people that's not that occupied with religion, but they are preoccupied with spirituality. And so so my thing is really about spirituality. I've got this giant 8-foot Buddha in my Zen garden. And I'm like, it's not because I'm a Buddhist, but do I subscribe to peace? Can the teachings of Buddhism, can the teachings of Islam, can the teachings of Judaism, can the teachings of people that don't believe in any God, can they teach me something that makes me more at peace, that makes me more positive, that makes me push myself to be my best? That's what I'm attracted to. You never hear me really ask people. I've never asked, what do you believe? I never asked Connie, what does he believe? I never ask. I get a sense, these are some good brothers that positivity. Mm-hmm. So whatever you call it is really none of my business. It really isn't. What is my business is how you treat me.
Sure.
And how I see you treat others, because I don't want to be around you treating me well, and yet you treat. And that's sometimes what Christians, that's what Hollywood does. But it's just, I've seen people be rude, and then once they realize that so-and-so's a star or someone's on a show, they change. But Hollywood, of course, stardom is the god, and that allows you to treat people any way you want to treat them. I don't go.
As one of your good friends, man, I can attest to that and tell you how much we appreciate that that's who you are. The book is Laws of Annihilation. It's the third installation, although there's a little bit of a cliffhanger now at the end of...
I've already got the fourth one. It's not a trilogy anymore.
Okay, so I'm correcting myself as we speak.
I think I'll probably end up at around six. So I don't know.
Okay.
Whole trilogy.
Eric, man, I want to thank you, brother, for taking the time, for getting me a copy of Laws of Annihilation a little bit ahead of when it was coming out. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I absorbed it as I did the other two. And for your time today, man, big respect for you, my brother. And I just thank you, man, for joining me.
Same here, brother. Definitely an honor. Like I said, I've been looking forward to us chopping it up like this for a long time. So I'm glad we did.
Let's come back after book six.
There we go, brother.
Peace, man.
Hey, thanks, brother. Peace.